The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with,
even in 100,000 myriad kalpas.
Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. So today, I would like to talk about reflections on transfer of merit and the journey home. I'd like to start by reading the beginning of an article written by Reverend Master Fu Den in the summer of 2012 called Undistracted on Our Journey Home. I have heard that animals maintain a greatly focused attentiveness when they are migrating. They will resist being distracted by what might generally turn them aside and remain undeterred by threats that would usually prevent them from following their course. It is as though their whole attention stays on their crucially important journey. Distraction and fear, they often keep us from pursuing the course we are being asked to follow on our spiritual journey. When faced with the complicated twists and turns that living has brought in recent times, I sense more than ever the urgency to keep intention and purpose as clear as I am able to on this journey and not get distracted from it. It takes all we've got to keep ourselves solidly focused on what is really important in life and not get sidetracked by what in the end has no lasting significance. A teaching that has been in my heart is, look to the eternal, not to the phenomena. And then he goes on to say, we should never despise the world of phenomena. It is where we live and train and fulfill our purpose. It and the jewel are not two. But what he talks about is our relationship to phenomena and to the world around us. If we end up making our home in this way of being, we are likely to get lost. What is needed from us is not unlike what we are taught in formal meditation, to remain open for everything while not involving ourselves in it with the grasping mind. If it is our wish to use our life force in a way which is in accord with that which has true meaning, it is necessary we recognize where we get distracted from the course we are being asked to follow to fulfill this meaning. For spiritual life is about following, in the same way that the migrating animals are following a course which is part of a picture that is much bigger than their individuality. And when we get distracted from that following, what results is confusion. When I read this last part, I remembered my ordination ceremony. One of the most vivid things in that ceremony I'll just backtrack a moment and say there's no rehearsal. There's no rehearsal for an ordination ceremony. What you need to do is just turn up. Just need to be there. And you are given guidance and help all along the way. And at one part of the ceremony, the ordinand is led around the hall and makes bows at the doors, representing saying goodbye to worldly ways of thinking, and also makes bows to those who have been key in helping them along the way, including their family and their teachers. I remember Reverend Master Hario was Reverend Master Jiyu's chaplain for this ceremony, and he was leading me around the hall. And at every point, he would turn to me and say, "Will you come? Will you come?" And, you know, I can still see his welcoming, his beckoning. So, what I want to say, I feel like this image of the migrating animals is such a wonderful and powerful image, and I think of migrating birds, flocks of birds. Actually, as we know, animals and birds, you know, they migrate in groups. You think they don't do too well going on their own. So there's this lovely aspect of being on the journey with others. We all have this homing instinct. We all have it. You know, we call it Buddha nature. We all have it. It's what brought you here today. You know, on a beautiful Sunday morning like this, you might have been skiing, you might have taken a hike, you might have been home reading the newspapers, eating Danish, you know, these are all... you know, these are all good options. Okay, but you decided to come here. And something brought you here. Many years of my monastic life, I worked in the guest office as a guest monk. And I was struck by how many times people would say when they came here for the first time, "It feels like coming home. Feels like coming home." And they would usually take a deep breath, actually, you know, and say, "Ah, you know, something just relaxes." And the way that I understand that is that when we find ourselves in a monastery or a church or a temple, some place where there is teaching that resonates within us, we allow ourselves to get in touch with that which is greater than ourselves. Something within us knows we're in a safe place and we can just let go. So I always think of the deep breath as being part of that, because part of what we're doing there, I think, is unloading some baggage. And actually, as I heard a Tibetan teacher say recently, when you unload luggage, it's very relaxing. He said. So, for us, it is Buddhism. For others, it can be another religious path. But we all have this homing instinct. It's one of the five Buddhist laws of the universe. All beings have an intuitive knowledge of the unborn, or that which is greater than ourselves. And this is how Reverend Master Jiyu talks about it in the introduction to the tradition of serene reflection meditation. Under the passage on the five laws of the universe, this is the fifth one. "The intuitive knowledge of Buddha nature occurs to all. All beings have the intuitive knowledge of the Buddha nature. Hence the creation of religions and precepts down the centuries. When man does not heed this intuitive knowledge, body and spirit separate, and the cycle of birth, old age, disease, and death becomes as a binding cord from which he cannot be free, until he again decides to heed the still small voice within, which is the voice of that intuitive knowledge that comes directly from the non-personal Buddha nature. As a result of modern thinking, man educates his children away from this, and with the spread of materialism, man is increasingly looking for the cure of physical and mental illness outside of himself rather than within, and the young become steadily more confused at an earlier and earlier age. And luckily, there is something within us that remembers, and that is the coming home. You know, that word remember means to bring to mind again, you know, something that we already know. So our practice is to learn to get in touch with our homing instinct and to trust it. And we do that through our meditation practice and through the precepts. We all have Buddha nature, whether or not we want it, whether we know it, whether or not we see it, and nothing is ever going to change that, no matter what we may say or do. Sometimes we're acting in harmony with it, and sometimes we are not. I find living next to this wonderful mountain is a daily teaching, because we know that mountain is there whether or not we can see it, you know, and we have to act in recognition of the fact that it's there, you know. Even if we can't see it, we can't just go down the road and turn right and go straight because we don't see the mountain. It's there whether or not we can see it. So we all have this homing instinct, and that is the all is one. And the way that it manifests is the all is different. I find the definition of the word religion is compelling. And here's that re again, R-E. There's a lot of R-E's in my talk today because, you know, it means, again, coming back, coming home, redoing, touching base with what we already know. So re means do it again. Ligios is the same root as ligaments. So it's connecting, you know, we are reconnecting. We are coming home and we are recognizing our connection with all things. And again, the word recognize means, you know, to know again, recognize, to recognize. So through the transfer of merit, we can actually experience that connection. And this is the basis for the practice of transferring merit, that of course that connection is there. There are many traditional forms, as we know. We just had this wonderful ceremony. In the deepest sense, of course, we don't know how this works, but we know what some of the aspects are. Because of the fact that there is merit, the innate goodness in the universe, which exists in all things and all beings, we can transfer merit. We can create merit with our good intentions, with our beneficial actions and thoughts. It works because we are all profoundly interconnected and affect one another. I recently read a book called Proof of Heaven by Dr. Evan Alexander, who is a brain surgeon whose reality was completely scientific until he had a very profound near-death experience. His brain shut down completely. He had a just incredibly serious brain infection. They had no idea where it came from. And he was in a coma for 7 days. And he writes about many aspects of his experience. It's really quite an amazing book, but I want to just mention one or two things that he discovered. He was actually able to appreciate his years of scientific training. He was very much a scientist. He loved science. He had no interest in religion. He had no really religious connection or no draw to religion whatsoever. But in this experience, the truth of what he has learned as a scientist was proved to him. You could say he followed the Buddhist teaching, prove it true for yourself. He ran directly into something that was much bigger than himself and was able to experience it firsthand. And looking through the eyes of Buddha nature, he says, all the objects in the physical universe are made up of atoms. Atoms, in turn, are made up of protons, electrons, and neutrons. These, in turn, as physicists also discovered in the early years of the 20th century, these are, in turn, all particles. There's a lot about that we don't know about all this, but one thing we do know is that everything is connected to every other, each particle is connected to every other particle in the universe. And he goes on to say that each of us are intricately, irremovably connected to the larger universe. It is our true home. And thinking that this physical world is all that matters is like shutting oneself up in a small closet and imagining there's nothing else out beyond it. And he says the crucial power of, he discovered the crucial power of belief in facilitating mind over matter. I think we might, the way I understand that is he found out that faith was the catalyst. And he says, I was often bemused as a medical student over the confounding power of the placebo effect. That medical studies had to overcome the 30% or so benefit that was attributed to a patient's believing he was receiving medicine that would help him, even if it was an inert substance. I must say I've always had a great fondness for the placebo effect and have a profound belief in it myself. And he says, but the interesting thing for him was that the medical field, instead of seeing the underlying power of belief as a positive thing, how it could actually help people, they were concerned that it was an obstacle to the demonstration of a treatment. So they didn't quite see how to make use of it. So what essentially, he goes on to describe in great detail what it seems to me is described in the Avatamsaka scripture and many other Buddhist scriptures. The interconnection, the profound interconnection, the profound goodness, benevolence, and love, which is expressed in the aspects of the universe. But it is very interesting in this book to hear how someone who was trained as a scientist then experiences this from an entirely different point of view. But basically what he does is he confirms there's a bigger picture. You know, this takes me back to that one of my favorite pieces of scripture that Reverend Master Hubert translated, that there are 84,000 parts to the sentient being and only one of them is the intellect. That leaves a lot of other parts to take in the Dharma. Not, you know, and it doesn't need to even bypass our brains, don't necessarily have to be in it. Involved at all, although it's nice every once in a while to let the brain in on what's going on. But so in transferring merit, coming back to that aspect of what we're talking about here, there are many traditional ways of doing it. the ceremony that we just had, in which we offered scriptures and we circumambulated and offered incense and the invocations for the benefit of those in need, those are profoundly helpful, as we know, and very much part of Buddhist traditions, been going on for centuries. We also transfer merit during morning service. There's always a transfer of merit offered at the end of scriptures. We offer incense. We can offer our meditation. We can offer a donation. We can offer a meal. These are all ways that people are familiar with that we transfer merit. But actually, anything works if it is a sincere offering. So I would like to give you several examples of how trainees found their own way with this practice by really trusting their own hearts. And the effect that this practice had on them and on others. And both of them have given me permission to share their experiences with you. So this first one is an experience that Kathy Martin wrote about in the winter of 1999 journal. Some of you may remember Kathy as the former Reverend Vera. She was a monk for some few years. But she wrote this article when she was a lay trainee. It's called Following Good Advice. Hang on, let me see, where do we start here? So this began with the death of her horse, whose name was Nova. Nova had died suddenly in the prime of his life, and he was such a good-hearted, generous, forgiving being. Our daily interactions over the years provided me not just with companionship and exercise and joy, but also with immense and complex teachings. Ultimately, he propelled me back into a closer and more active contact with the Abbey and our Sangha. His death has been a great teaching for me. Since we weren't able to schedule a memorial service, there was a suggestion made to place a photo of him on my altar and offer merit. And she goes on to say, well, putting his picture on my Kanzan altar was easy, but I found I didn't know how to offer merit, which I have found many people say. We are not really familiar with this practice here in the West. She said, I reread the journal articles, and I read the offertories that came at the end of scripture recitations, and nothing seemed right. In fact, the bottom line was, I didn't really believe that anything I did generated any merit. So what did I have to offer? It's another common dilemma that we have, isn't it? Still, I did want to try to follow the monk's advice. So I groped along for a while, and eventually my practice consisted of, one, putting on my wagesa, which we know represents the precepts, offering incense, looking at his photo, putting my hands in gassho, acknowledging whatever arose in me, gratitude, regrets, memories, grief, and then bowing. I found I was bowing to Nova, bowing to Kanzan, bowing to what had arisen in me, to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to my not knowing and my efforts to train. I particularly appreciate the not knowing. We don't have to know. And we can bow to that. And still, something is going on. She said, that felt right, so I continued. Then there was a suggestion made to put a picture of my mother on my altar, and it came about during a phone conversation in which I had briefly mentioned to the monk how difficult our relationship had been and how I'd given up on ever being able to reconcile due to her severe Alzheimer's disease. This time, due to my resistance, it took several days for me actually to follow this advice. Now, I also want to say everybody's smiling, okay, because we all know that as a matter of fact. Sometimes people say, gee, they should be offering merit to me. It was really their fault. You know? So, okay, whatever comes up, you know, there it is. And she says, but, you know, I wanted to do it. Then she says, once I did talk about the opposites arising, there was good Nova on the left. There was bad Mom on the right. And there was also the issue of how to offer merit to a fundamentalist Christian who believed that Buddhism is a dangerous cult. Yet, underneath all the commotion was a steady desire to somehow come to feel better towards her in my heart. As I was, so she was having difficulties with this, and the suggestion was made to that she should remember to have compassion for herself and to know that her mother herself and the relationship between them was already in the embrace of the eternal. She said, this helped me loosen my grip on the problem. I found I was able to look at her photo and at least feel genuine gratitude for the sheer fact she'd been willing to allow me to come into this world through her body. Then as the days and weeks rolled on, I began to feel something happening, at first subtle and inexpressible, and it began to get easier. Memories percolated into my mind without such a thick coating of resentment, bitterness, and blame. She saw that her mother, she had some memories of her mother actually trying to reconcile with her before the Alzheimer's set in. She said that involuntary negative reaction at the sight of her face finally wore itself out, and I began to consider her, as I already did Nova, as a fellow trainee at a distance. I still didn't know what I was doing. I only knew that I should continue. So she is continuing to follow her heart. And then she goes on to say that in fact she was so encouraged by the changes that she was experiencing within herself that she started to work on several other troubled relationships that she had. One with her ex-husband and another with a dear friend with whom she'd been very close for 30 years, and then the friend simply disappeared. They had some kind of something within them reached a critical mass and we fractured apart, and she disappeared out of my life without a trace. And she found herself standing before that altar with all of these photos on it, most often after a meditation period, and look at each one of them and silently say, okay, you all, if there's anything of value in what I have done, I'd like to share it with you. Sometimes I would suggest we take refuge together in the eternal, and sometimes I just thank them for their part in my life and wish them well. She said, I must confess I still don't really understand the transfer of merit and how it works. I only know that it does. Now, sometime after she began offering merit from her friend, for her friend. Her friend called her. And they had a long talk and a reconciliation. And my recollection was that she had had some really quite wonderful visits with her mother after this period of offering merit. So I emailed her and I asked her, first of all, if it was okay with her for me to talk about her experience. And I said I thought that she had had a chance to be together with her mother before she died. And this is an email that she sent back. Mom and I did have some wonderful, close, and happy moments the last part of her life. As it turned out, once her mind was sufficiently impaired, those memories and habitual ways of our communicating that had been so problematic just dissolved. She said, all we had left was a heart-to-heart connection, and we could be together in a sort of generic way. Two people singing a song. Once she could no longer speak, she could still sing, clapping our hands and laughing. She said, the last visit that we had together, my brother took some photos, and when I look at them, all that's left of our difficult relationship is love and gratitude and joy. Now, the power of memory is really something that I think is worth reflecting on. This letter put me in mind of one of my favorite vignettes that a young woman told me, which was that she had been in a car accident and had very serious amnesia for 3 months, couldn't remember anything. During that time, her relationship with her husband improved, she said, 100%. She said the reason it improved was because she couldn't remember why she was angry with him. When her memory came back, the relationship sort of went back to what it had been. Now, isn't that something? I mean, I could spend a really long time just reflecting on, the impact of that in my own life. And just watching it operate as time passes. So I wanted to tell you about an experience that another trainee told me about with regard to transferring merit. He was talking about some issues and misunderstandings that had come up with his grown son. And they had tried to straighten things out through email. As we know, this is not always the communication of choice during these kinds of situations. And actually, things got a lot worse. And, things did not get resolved. And felt a lot of anger still and a lot of sadness. And didn't really know what to do about it. So once again, I suggested putting his son's picture on his altar. I just find this to be a very powerful way of resolving many things. I have found it helpful myself many times. And to offer merit for him. And he got over the initial resistance that we all have, and he said, okay. And then some months later, he stopped me to remind me of this conversation. And he said he'd been offering merit for some months for his son. He didn't know whether it was helping his son because he had still not heard from him, but it was certainly helping him. He said he continues to light a candle and offer merit and loving kindness to his son every morning. He's been able to make peace with whatever the relationship is and whatever it will be. But he himself had been estranged from his own father for something like 10 years. And it's been a source of great sadness for him. And he hopes that he and his son will be able to reconcile before his death. This is another clear example of how the transferring merit helps us in the very doing of it, and how karma gets converted through this this practice. So I would say that on our journey home, we are continually correcting our course. It's not a straight shot, and it really doesn't have to be. But what the thing that we need to have the faith in is our ability to correct our course. Reverend Master Jiu used to say, "I can't teach anybody who's not willing to make mistakes." Now that was certainly a shift for me when I heard that. That was the farthest thing that I had been brought up with, because I think our society tends to emphasize learning how not to make mistakes, and then if you do make them, how to avoid admitting to them. I am sorry to say, but I, you know, really, just facing our mistakes, looking them in the eye, and owning up to them and saying we're sorry is not really something that we value very much in our society. And the inability to do that has caused untold suffering in our personal lives, in our political lives, in our economic lives, you know, all over the place. So the teaching of sitting up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and ancestors when we have made a mistake. And this is a very hard teaching for us to accept, I think, because we, although what we do is actually a practice, you know, we say we're doing Zen practice, we get very worried about, we kind of lose sight of the word practice, and we start worrying about perfection. But we aren't really interested in perfection. I mean, if we were, we would call this Zen perfect, you know, but we don't. It's a practice. It's a practice. And, the dictionary is really so incredibly helpful to help us clear up a lot of confusion. So when I looked up the word practice, there was a half a page of definitions. Most of them refer to the need to do something repeatedly over and over again in order to, for the purpose of learning something. Now, isn't that wonderful, really? So that should be a clue for us. This business of having to come back over and over again, and that's what so many of our practices are, this starting with the beginning of the day where we make the vow to say take the precepts just for the day, and we're going to keep coming back to it throughout that day. And this is a recognition, really, of the power of karma. Karma is so powerful that we are told that it takes eight equally powerful forces to overcome it. And that's the Eightfold Path. That's the Eightfold Path. So I'd like to end with some words from our ceremony of the Buddha's Parinirvana, which we will be celebrating later on this month. These several lines from his last teachings I refer to over and over again, because to me it means that he understood completely the nature of the journey and our humanness and the trusts and the turns, the twists and the turns. And the lines are: quickly seek your liberation. Be a lamp unto yourself. That is, trust the light within. but always seek to get back on the path.